Hi, everybody. Good morning. Last week I kind of left you hanging, just to reiterate the kind of thrust of this mini course, I'm trying to build up the case that is called philosophical halachist, that without philosophy, without a study outside, so to speak, and that'll have to be redefined a little bit, outside knowledge, if there is such a thing for the Rambam, if there is such a thing as outside knowledge, it's virtually impossible to not just to be an accomplished person, but it's virtually impossible to be a halachic Jew, and it's virtually impossible to be a halachic Jew in the most important sense of the word. That is the very first three, at least, or four, or five mitzvot, and I would argue all of them, but the most important ones, he lists them first, and he often talks about that everything really boils down to the first two, which is the existence of God and his unity. I think everybody here would agree that those are probably the most important, and they're mitzvot, according to the Rambam at least, that you can't possibly accomplish those mitzvot. Of knowledge of God, knowledge of his unity, and love of God and fear of God, without a comprehensive knowledge of what's going on in the world. So this is very, very, I mean, it's not just, be a better person, it's virtually, you can't be a fully accomplished halachic Jew. So last week I left you hanging with a halacha, call it, technically, it's not maybe halacha, but it's in his halachot Talmud Torah, Hilchot Talmud Torah, and this was in that handout I gave you, if everybody has that. I don't know if you were here or have that. I don't know if I have another copy, but... call it good advice, but it's part of Hilchot Talmud Torah, and this is that first source in that second handout, Perek Aleph Halacha Yud Aleph. So here he picks up on a Gemara, but he changes things. So here, Chayav L'Shalesh Etzman L'Midato. So one has to divide his time into three parts in terms of learning. Shlish B'Tor Shebiktav, Shlish B'Tor Shebapeh, Shlish Yavin V'Yaskil. So this is important again. He should understand, use his intellect. Yaskil Achrit Davar Mereshito. Be proficient in the method of deductive knowledge, v'yotzi davar midavar, to derive something from something else, v'yedameh davar ledavar, be able to argue by analogy, v'yavin b'midot sh'atara nedreshet behen, understand those rules by which you derive halachot. Some of them are logical rules, a fortiori rules, that is argument from a lesser to a larger principle. Some of them are not what we consider completely logical. Achieda heich hu ikar midot veheich yotzi yisur v'amutar, how you derive halachot ukiyotz behen midvarm shalamad b'piyashmua, and also other things that we know by way of transmission, oral law. Ve'inyin ze hu hanikra gemara. And this is called Gemara. It's a little twist on the origin, the source of this, which is in a Gemara in Kedushin. And there it says, "Lo'olam yishalesh adam shnotav." So it's all his years, his entire time on this planet has to be divided into three: shlish b'mikra, shlish b'mishnah, v'shlish b'talmud. Okay. So notice the Rambam already, which is interesting in its own right, kind of separates Talmud, or calls it Gemara, from Torah Shebal Peh. So you have where the original says Mikra, Mishnah, Talmud, we have Torah Shebiktav, Torah Shebal Peh, and Gemara. So bear that in mind for a moment. Then the next halacha, he talks about the practical, how do I practically achieve this, right? If I'm if I work for a living, and I'm not going to get into that issue here, that could be a whole other course, but in this very chapter, right before this halacha, I'll just give you one sentence and you can kind of surmise for yourself what he thought about learning a trade or a profession. Gedolei Chachmei Yisrael, the greatest sages of Israel, haya mehem chotvei etzim, umehem shovei mayim, umehem sumin. So they were chopped wood, they drew water. Afal pi kein, hayu oskin b'torah b'yom v'layla. So it's possible to... This is the immediately before this halakha that I have here is that. And then later on, this does not go without its criticism. Later on, when he mentions this again and talks about, Rambam is famous for this, that you're not allowed to take money or earn a living, at least for sure from teaching Torah Shebaal Peh, the Kesef Mishnah, the Rav Yosef Karo, who is his great adherent, but also not hesitant to criticize him when he needs to, has a very, very long piece on this to try and kind of soften its effect. But be that as it may, let's look at Halacha Yud Beis, which is that second source there. Ketzad haya bal umanut v'haya osek malachto. How do people that have a trade, how do they divide their time this way? So he says they have basically 3 hours to do their work, 9 hours to learn. Tesha kora otana tesha. So those three, they divide. Those nine, they divide. Kore b'shalosh mehen b'torsh b'ktav. So they read Tanakh. U'b'shalosh b'torsh b'alpeh. 3 hours they do torsh b'alpeh. U'b'shalosh achirot mitponein b'dato lahavin davar midavar. So here he picks up on the last definition in the previous halacha of Gemara, b'divrei Kabbalah b'chlal Torah shebiktav hein, u'pirshim b'chlal Torah shebal peh, v'ha'anyanim hanikraim pardes, and this is what I'm going to concentrate on now a little bit, those matters that are called pardes, this is a Persian loan word that occurs a few times in later books in the Tanakh. You can see maybe an analogy to paradise. Pardes is a word generally taken as a garden. I think it's the times that it's used is usually associated with the king's garden, which is interesting. That is, it's a place that's reserved for an important person. But he's picking up on, and he's alluding here to some important Gemara. We'll talk about that in a second. But what's important is here, he's including here something that the original source does not at all. Okay, so this is his own innovation. That is what's included in that third part that's called Gemara are those things that are called pardes. Okay, and we'll in a minute we'll see what his definition of pardes is. Bamed var mamurim, and this is important too. When this kind of division of your time, when does this apply? This doesn't apply all your life, by the way. This only applies at the beginning, b'tchilat talmudo shel adam. Only at the beginning, when you're, you know, building up your storehouse of knowledge, and you're becoming adept at deductive knowledge and analytic knowledge, this is what you do. Aval kashyagdil b'chachma, when you, amass a lot of wisdom. Chachma, by the way, is also, you see, this is, just as an aside, this is the difficulty of a lot of people when they read the Rambam. That is, a lot of words and terms have technical meanings. And we tend to read these things in terms of our own. I talked about Mada the other day. If you're a modern Hebrew speaker, you give it some meaning. If you're kind of a Jew who's raised in an Orthodox world, let's say in a yeshiva world, you give chachma another meaning. The Rambam uses the word chachma intentionally because it is somewhat ambiguous. That is, it clearly does allude to chachmat Torah, let's say, chachmat Elohim, divine knowledge, and chachma in the Mishnah Torah and certainly in the Guide of the Perplexed, alludes to outside sciences. Okay, so you always have to be careful when you're reading these things. They're very precise. The Rambam is known for being precise in all worlds. You have to give them the benefit of looking at a word when it's an important word and finding those places. Sometimes it's a matter of, let's say, plugging it in, now we have CD-ROMs, and looking for that word wherever it appears in the Rambam, and you'll find that it is richer than what maybe you originally thought. So when you grow amass wisdom, it's not that necessary to involve yourself in Torah Shebiktav and Torah Shebaal Peh, those first two divisions. So you do it, you know, you involve yourself just to refresh your memory because you don't want to lose it, but it's not any more a necessary part of your division of your time, right? It's no longer necessary to learn what he says, Torah Shebiktav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? I mean, I think we're agreed here that. Well, maybe I shouldn't. I should never say that we're agreed. But I think this is a plain reading of it, that it's only necessary to read it to refresh your memory, so you may preserve it. And from then on in, what you have to dedicate all your time is to Gemara. Right? And remember how he defined Gemara. Bilvad, and this is important, this expression here, lefi rochav shiesh belibo v'yishuv dati. In accordance with how expansive his mind is, I would say, lev is very often, sometimes the seat of the emotions, sometimes it's the seat of wisdom, sometimes the kidneys are. I think here it means not emotions, but here it means the mind. That is, you involve yourself in Gemara, and remember, Gemara includes a number of things, including this thing called pardes, according to how expansive your mind is, and v'yishuv dato. So remember this phrase. And according to how yishuv dato is a hard phrase to also translate, but let's say to how relaxed you are or how comfortable you are in the world. Now, these terms will come up again. So in order to really understand this, you have to understand what pardes is, obviously. So pardes is...
Where did he define the term Gemara before?
Right in the first source that you have there.
Okay,
he defined Gemara. So what I said he added, which was unique. I mean, this has its source in the Gemara, as virtually everything that the Rambam does. Always there's a source. There's always, you look for, always, that's very important, right? It's good that you raise that because you always look back at the original source and then look at the Rambam side by side. Always a little twist, not always, but very often a little twist at an important time, and the little twists are very meaningful. And more often than not, the classic commentators, Rabbi Yosef Karo, do comment on this and note it. These guys were no slouches either. So pardes. Pardes, I'm sure some of you know, maybe not all of you, but pardes... originates one very famous Gemara in Chagiga, which has very famous, what's that? Arba Nechnas of Pardes, right? The very famous four great Tanaim, Rabbi Akiva, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Akiva the most famously known, and another guy named Elisha Ben Avuya, my favorite friend, my favorite guy. I shouldn't have even mention his name, but Gemara Achir, his name is mentioned a number of times. In Pirkei Avot, he leaves a teaching by his name. So, and you know, those of you who know Rabbi Akiva wouldn't decide. They decide to take a walk in this garden, to take a stroll in this garden. Rabbi Akiva wouldn't decide to take a walk with slouches, right? So these are very great Tanaim. We know from other Gemaras, other Mishnayot, that they were of the greatest. The long and short of it is, most people take it as referring to some kind of mystical field, some kind of esoteric body of knowledge, where these people, these great Tanaim, would normally be involved in halachic discussions, Isur and Mutar, what the Rambam is saying is part of Gemara. But here they decide to go outside that realm and take a trip. So if you look at the Mefarshim, I think it's Tosfot, or even at Rashi and Tosfot, say they use the name of God to travel. You know, this is kind of it's a transcendental trip to the nether reaches of human knowledge, which go beyond simply the concrete knowledge, substantive knowledge. Anyways, the long and short of it is they enter this pardes, and the pardes is such an esoteric field that only one of them comes back safe and sound. That is safe in body and sound in mind. And that is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says, Nichnash b'shalom v'yatza b'shalom v'nichnas b'shalom v'yatza b'shalom, or different, there's different girsaot depending which version you look at, Yerushalmi, Bavli. Rabbi Akiva comes out okay. One of them dies. One of them goes insane, let's say. And Elisha ben Avuya comes out, and I'll use this term very loosely, as a heretic. So the pardes here is taken from that makor. But the Rambam's view of pardes, and I would say here, if you ask my own opinion, I would say that that those who say that it is some kind of mystical knowledge are probably right. This is some kind of trip into some kind of mystical. There was a mysticism known as Heichalot mysticism, where they would go transcend this world and go through various kind of levels of palaces until they got to a supernal palace where God resided. Pshat-wise, I think that's probably true. The Rambam gives it a very, very different twist. The Rambam, who is not, by and large, known as a mystic, who's known as a rationalist, gives it a different twist. So in the Mishnah in Chagiga, for instance, upon which this Gemara is a commentary, where it tells you that you're not allowed to teach certain things like Maaseh Breishit, an account of the creation, and Maaseh Merkava, an account of the chariot, Maaseh Breishit referring to the first couple of chapters in Breishit, which is about the creation of the world, Maaseh Merkava, which is referring to the first chapter of Ezekiel and Ezekiel's vision of this chariot and this grand, very anthropomorphic vision of God with these figures that have four faces and wings, both of which become the playing ground of mystics and mysticism, become the very basic fields of knowledge. The Rambam says there, in his commentary in the Mishnah, Maaseh Breishit refers to natural science, which means what we would call physics, let's say, and Maaseh Merkava refers to divine science, or what we refer to as metaphysics. So what he is saying there is that these two accounts, which is made up the ingredients that make up this garden, this pardes, are really all the scientific and philosophical knowledge of his day, which basically boils down to Aristotle and the way Aristotelian knowledge was transmitted. So again, I think going back to your question last week, whether the science is correct or not, I think is important, but it's almost beside the point for what I'm trying to prove. That is, whatever the science of the day is, and whatever he thought was demonstrable, he considers to be included in this field of pardes. So, pardes is part of Gemara, right? Pardes is part of Gemara. Not only is it part of Gemara, and this is the addition that he has, the innovation that he has to its original source in the Gemara, right, about dividing your time, but that when you grow older, and this is the way I would see this, that is, that expression, lefi rochav sheyesh belibo, v'yishuv dato, would mean to me, and here we can debate, and I'm sure people would argue with me, but I'll try and prove this, is that virtually exclusively the part of Gemara that you would have to involve yourself in if you became proficient in all these other things that he talked about would be exclusively the pardes, would be exclusively those things we would call physics and metaphysics. The other things, Gemara, Halacha, Torah Shebiktav, Torah Shebaal Peh, you kind of go over for about a half hour in the morning to refresh your memory, to preserve it. But these things are the things you exclusively devote your time to. Now, let me.
What does he do with the Gemara in Sefer Yigal that says you should have gone to parties? He's assuming okay. You're only going to parties after you've mastered basically.
That's right.
Shas, in
right.
A sense.
Right. That's
and
right.
And he says that, at that point you're like Rabbi Akiva that you are
exactly
going.
Exactly. So it's not for everybody. Absolutely. And now, in direct response to your question, that's what I was going to go to next. That is, if you go to the first handout that I gave you, if everybody has that. And you look at the second page of that handout. Sorry, the first, right, I gave you one last week, and there was the first one. Does everybody have that? I have a couple of them. Who doesn't have? Okay. The first one? Okay, so don't leave them here, because I know people leave them here. So don't.
I have one already.
Okay, I have one more. But don't leave, take them back with you, because I'll, you know. I always plan these things. I never get past the first handout that I give. So so what you have, the first source on the second page, and here is where I'm trying to show and prove, back up what I just said. Inyanei arba prakim elu. Everybody has that? So the issues that I discussed in these first four prakim. So these are the first four prakim, the first four chapters of Yesodei HaTorah. And in there, I don't want to go through those, but basically, he discusses what he considers to be physics and metaphysics, things that refer to natural science, to a knowledge of the world, right, and things that cover what is beyond the world and God. And he has a very detailed discussion of this. Remember, this is Hilchot. This is Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah. People forget that, right? This is included the very beginning of his Halachot, and for good reason. So it says all these issues, shebechamesha mitzvot eilu, that are comprised, by the way, without a knowledge of these things, you cannot accomplish the first five mitzvot that he lists, which is the knowledge of God. Remember, we talked about that there is no other God, his unity, to love him and to fear him. Okay, so these are the very essential building blocks of Judaism, the building blocks of halachic Judaism. These things are what the Chachamim Rishonim karin oto pardes. This is what they called pardes. Kemosha Amar, and then he refers directly to that Arba Nechnasula pardes. The Afalpi, and then referring to, even though they were great, they're great Chachamim, not everybody was able, I'll try to skip a bit, to Latayel Bapardes, not everybody was able to take a stroll in this garden, except those Shenit Malei Kreso Lechem Basar, also a kind of a rabbinic phrase, somebody who's filled his belly with bread and meat. Velech, and what is bread and meat? Leida Ha'isur Vamutar Ukiyot Behemishar Mitzvot. So remember, the source that I brought you before. To know, this is the bread and butter. The bread and butter, which one has to fill his belly with, is knowledge of halakha. And now here's the very important thing.
Is he implying, I mean, what he's saying is Ben Azai Ben Zoma, he can't be saying they didn't have a knowledge of halakha. In other words, why did they fail in Pardes?
Okay.
If they had the bread and butter, and presumably we have less bread and butter than
the okay. Let me finish. He does deal with Elisha ben Avuya mainly, in why Elisha ben Avuya failed. And you can extrapolate to the others too, that it's the same reason. That is, they weren't prepared. They weren't prepared. Rabbi Kiva was prepared.
What does that mean?
That means, it's important. Okay, let me deal with this question because it's important. That is, that. For the Rambam, it's very important, and I talked about his curriculum, right? He has a curriculum laid out. He sent the letter to Joseph, remember? Logic, math, science, astronomy, and then we can talk about these things. So to give you a very beautiful image that he has of what the problem was with the other three, as opposed to Rabbi Akiva, he talks about in the first section of the guide, chapter 5, he talks about the great epiphany, the great revelation that Moshe had at the bush, right? And this is the way, and this is an answer to your question, what he thought was wrong, that Moshe followed, an advice that Moshe is a model for, that those guys did not follow. And that is, they weren't bad guys, they weren't like evil intention, they all went into this well-intentioned. What does Moshe do when he sees the burning bush? You remember what he does?
Take off his shoes.
Well, before he takes off his shoes, he covers his eyes, right? Ki yarei, because he's afraid to look at this. So the way the Rambam interprets that is, Moshe is on the road, as he interprets many of our biblical heroes. Moshe is an intellectual hero, just as Abraham is, and we'll look at Abraham in a moment. Going along the path, striving for knowledge of God. But you can't get that like that. Some people think that God simply comes to a Navi, and that may very well be. It looks like in Tanakh, all of a sudden you know nothing about Avraham, right? Nothing. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't say anything. Nothing. All of a sudden God appears to him and talks to him. Now, in the biblical image of that may very well be. I don't know. It may very well be that God just picks somebody and talks to him. For the Rambam, that's an impossibility. It's a logical impossibility that even God himself can't do. Because only somebody who's qualified. So the image of Moshe is the classic image of holding himself back, that he wants to. There's an image here of almost the supreme level of knowledge that a man can get to is contained in this bush. He wants to get there, right? There's an emotional drive to get there, but he knows he's not ready. So that's what he says is that. He restrains himself from jumping ahead because he's not yet well-versed in all the sciences and all the knowledge that he needs in order to grasp the essence of this vision. And this is the problem with those other Tanaim.
So how does he expect us to overcome the problem? Because,
he doesn't.
He does, but he says we have to do it.
Yeah, we have to strive for it. Let me just finish because you're right. The question is well taken and it's problematic. But this is his, and he also has another image, for instance, with Elisha ben Avuya that he talks about these. There's a pasuk that says, "Keep honey, under your tongue." That is, if the honey being the esoteric knowledge, if you eat too much honey, you barf, right? That is, too much of it. At one time, if you're not prepared for it, causes bad things to happen. You regurgitate. You
indigestion.
Right. But anyways, and this is what I wanted to point out, and a lot of people miss this, and that is, the afal pi shedvarim elu, listen to this, davar katan, the isur halacha, basically saying, is a small thing. Hold on a second. Karuaton chachamim, sharei amru chachamim, because they said, and this is also a Gemara, davar gadol, a big thing, is masa merkava, v'davar katan havayot de abaye verava. A big thing is masa merkava, a small thing is all the debates. Havayot de abaye verava is a classic phrase that encompasses Gemara, basically. All, when you open up any page of Gemara, it doesn't mean literally those discussions that go on between abaye verava, he means all discussions in the Gemara, the give and take. Now, afal pi kein ru'uyin hein lakdiman, even though they're a small thing, now we're getting to what that means, because a small and big can mean two main things. It can mean quantitative, or it can mean qualitative. Right? Now, it can't mean quantitative, because havayat abaye verava is pretty large corpus of material, probably much larger even, I would say, than the Aristotelian body of knowledge. By the way, in terms of ancient civilization, that is, ancient literature from the first three or four centuries, the largest by far text that we have over any other text is the Gemara. I think when Yaakov Elman was here, I think he said he counted. I don't know if he counted specifically. He probably did in his mind because he has that kind of mind. 1,900,000 words or something like that. The next largest text, which he studies, which is the Persian Zoroastrian text, is less than half that. So, in terms of a corpus of material giving us some knowledge of that that era, that's pretty large. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I am sure that this is not talking quantitatively. So why do you, even though this is a small thing, why do you bother with it? Why do you bother with this knowledge of halakha, basically, and all the give and take in the Gemara? Shehen miyashvin. Now, remember, do you remember this phrase? Shehen miyashvin da'ato shel adam tchila. Remember the first makor, the first source that I brought in Hilchot Talmud Torah. When you get to the point where you become proficient in all this knowledge, you learn Gemara, which contains pardes, according to how expansive your mind is, and v'yishuv da'ato. Okay? So here, halacha, he says, and havaya at the Bayi V'Rava, their goal is to... this is a political goal, by the way. What it means is it's a socio-political, socio-psychological political goal. It makes the study of halacha, the study of the give and take in the Gemara, grounds somebody, maybe in ethics, most certainly in ethics. It grounds somebody as a contributing member of his social group. We know this. I mean, the study of halacha does do this, right? If you study it, no matter what it says in there, you're going to be part of a framework that has a moral framework, that has a legal framework. You're going to be a functioning, contributing member of society. That's what miyashvin da'ato shel adam is. And the efsher shiyadam hakol, and it's possible that everybody has access to this knowledge. Everybody has access to this knowledge. Katan, gadol, children, adults, ish v'isha, men and women, ba'al lev rachav, u'ba'al lev katzar. Remember, again, lev rachav. So we have both those expressions that I had in that first source here. Ba'al lev rachav is obviously somebody who is well beyond somebody lev katzar. Somebody whose expansive is much beyond, in terms of academic proficiency, than one who has a narrow mind. A narrow mind, that's the way I would translate it. A broad mind and a narrow mind. So...
Was his adding of Isha, was that extremely progressive for that one?
He's not... I'm an academic, so I don't want to hide anything. His attitude towards women is that women generally are inferior. And what I mean here is they're intellectually inferior to men. However, with one writer, because it's an important thing to know, that is, and this is an important thing to know both with respect to this issue, gender issues, and Jew-Gentile issues, that is, he is not, as opposed to other strains in Judaism, and I would say probably maybe more dominant strains that have taken hold of Judaism, largely because maybe of mysticism, that see an essential, that what I mean here, the word is used in philosophy, an ontological, an essential inferiority. That is, he did not see that. That is, it's functional. I mean, it's... That is given what I know, and I would say this, and again, this is debatable, but I think it's pretty clear. Women didn't have access to schools and didn't have access...
That's why he makes exceptions in Hilchot Talmud Torah, when he sort of is opposed to the woman of setting of Torship al Peh, but it's clear they're exceptional women, which of course is the basis of the old Heter today. And
right.
We assume that in our society, all women fall into the exception back to
right.
the Rambam.
Right, that's right. So
it's a functional thing.
Right. Daton kalot, he says. They're kind of feeble minded. But that doesn't mean.
He says that they have access to this.
That's right. And that gives you an idea of what he thinks of this study. But again, just the issue of gender, that is feeble-minded, doesn't mean that they're essentially feeble-minded. If they go to university and stuff, he would change his mind. That it's a function of course, he's responsible in some part for that too, of maybe barring women from that world. But they were barred from that world, and they were intellectually inferior because they didn't have access to that world. But it's a functional thing. Same thing as his attitude towards Goyim. Same thing. However, this is not the case in other dominant strains of Judaism, particularly mystical strains, particularly Yehuda Levi. I always see actually the Rambam, the Yehuda Levi, though he never mentions Yehuda Levi by name, he either certainly knew of him. Yehuda Levi died very, very shortly before the Rambam came on the scene. And we know from the Gniza, from documents we found in the Gniza, that Yehuda Levi actually was in Cairo before he left for Israel. So it's very unlikely that he did not know of Yehuda Levi, even though they were... But even, what's that?
Also, in Spain, that's
right, right. Udalevi is already, by the time he ends his life, is already developed a reputation. But even if he did not know of Udalevi, he certainly, without a doubt, knew of Udalevi's ideas. That is, those ideas are floating around. Okay, and those ideas are, if anybody knows Udalevi, are kind of, let's call it, racist ideas of that Jews are essentially superior. That kind of thing. So the Rambam did not subscribe to that kind of thing. But going back to this, so that's pardes. Pardes are those sciences. Pardes is something that somebody who has already accomplished yishuv da'at, that is already a functioning contributing member of society, can go on to. But this is very important. People miss this. The interpretation, this is taken from a Gemara, a very famous Gemara about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. That is, Hillel, famous Hillel HaZaken, had a large number of students, 80, I think it is, right? What? The smallest of them, the smallest student, the most inferior student was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Okay? And then it says Rabbi Yochanan... That's right, he knew everything. So he goes through Shalohi Niniach, who didn't miss a beat, in all these things, Mikra, Mishnah, Gemara, Halachot, Agadot, he knew the entire, this is the smallest student, right? He knew the entire corpus of, entire Jewish body of knowledge. He knew angelic talk. He knew all kinds of things, Agadot. And then it ends off with, and Davar Katan and Davar Gadol. And then the Gemara goes on to say, what's Davar Katan? Davar Katan is Havayot Dabayev Arava. Davar Gadol is Masim Rekava. Now, lest you think that Rambam is just picking up on what the Gemara says, this is one of the things you have to watch for with the Rambam. Because he is very, very careful here to get across his agenda. This, what he says here in his interpretation of Devar Katan and Devar Gadol, even though the Gemara associates these things, is unlike any interpretation, classical interpretation, before him given of that Gemara, and subsequently. That is, the traditional explanation of this Gemara is the following. And I have there two, underneath that source, Kesef Mishnah, which is Rabbi Yosef Karo, who gets a little bit disturbed at this, and Ritva, one of the Rishonim, Yontef Ibn Ishbili, who was more in the mystical side of things. However, if you look at the Kesef Mishnah, for instance, this is the way most of the Rishonim, Rashi, the Gaonim, all read this Gemara in terms of Davar Katan and Davar Gadol. That is, they didn't read it hierarchically. They didn't read it that this is superior knowledge and this is inferior knowledge. The way they read it was... The Katava ran Davar Katan Havaya Dabaya Varava Pirush. Mishum de Mikara Amar Shalohiniach Mikra Mishnah. First, don't forget, the listing is Mishnah, all those things that the Rambam already includes in Davar Katan. Havaya Dabaya Varava includes all these things, but here they're separate. Karila Havaya Dabaya Varava Davar Katan. Lefi, this is the reason, this is the general consensus. Shatanaim Harishonim. The early Tanaim, like Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, Hayu Yodim HaMishnah Al Burya, they knew Mishnah cold, off by heart. Havayot Dahavu Batar Hachi, Abaye V'Rava LeDavar Katan Chashvin in Lehu, what was considered a small thing, that is, and if we go to the, for later generations, was absolutely crystal clear to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. And then if you go to the next Ritva, you'll see, Havayot Dabai V'Rava, Heim Kushyot V'Tirutzin, all the give and take of the Gemara, are the questions and answers. And by the way, this is not so far from the truth. Anybody who's familiar with Gemara knows that, you know, three-quarters of the discussions are, what did these other guys say? We don't know what they said. We don't know what their sforot are. We don't know what they hold. They switch around. Rabbi Kiva said this. Rabbi Lezer said this. No, it's the opposite way around. A lot of the discussion is, they don't really know, because all this stuff is oral, what went on in the earlier generations. They're trying to retrieve that. So he says, the Ritva, Shalahem Shalonit Baru Lahem Mibne Shalo Yardula Omko Shel Talmud Ki Chachamim Rishonim. They didn't plumb the depths, they weren't able to plumb the depths of all this knowledge as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. So what are Havaya at the Bayav Rava are only there, the give and take, because they weren't clear about things. That's what Davar Katan means. That's what Davar Katan means. And then he goes on, Lefisha Yaza Michisoran Yidiya Karile Davar Katan. Bechachmat HaMishnah. And since it's a deficiency in knowledge of later generations, that's what small means. It's a value judgment on the relative knowledge of later generations as opposed to previous generations. Aval gadolhu mikol, the Ritva, who of course takes aim at the Rambam, comes from the Nachmanidean camp, from the camp that was part of the controversy that were anti-Maimonideans. He knows very well who he's aiming this at, right? But Mishnah and all this stuff, of course, is gadol hu mikol shar chachmat hagoyim. Vezeh haperush, he's aiming this specifically at the Rambam. Zeh perush emet v'nachon lekol ha-ma'amin. Maybe he's referring to ani ma'amin. I don't know. To anybody who thinks that he's a ma'amin, Rambam, you know who I'm talking about.
Right? I like the word gadol.
Right, that's right. That was good. Right, right. So that's right. Rabbi Nussbaum mentioned this as he ends off Ritva. V'lo kamo shepirshu acherim. Clearly alluding. He doesn't even want to mention. He treats him like Elisha ben Avuya, like acher. Right. The others who say clearly being Maimonides, halakim yechaper. May God forgive him. And the Kesef Mishnah, who is Rav Yosef Karo, who is by no means an anti-Maimonidean, who loves Maimonides, but also says, Halavai shelo nichtav. Halavai that he wouldn't have written this. But he did, what can I do? But this is important. That is, his hierarchical interpretation of these two bodies of knowledge is not the norm, is not what the Gemara said. And in fact, I would say that maybe these other Rishonim possibly are not twisting things in terms of the Pshat. I don't know. But the Rambam is clearly giving his own twist here. That is, Pardes, in direct opposition to Ritva, and the Ritva knew exactly who he was talking to, does mean Chachmot HaGoyim. Now, it doesn't just mean knowledge of that the Gentiles have. What it means is knowledge, truth, right? By the Rambam's kind of account of history, there is no such thing as Gentiles. This is something we've developed, right? We've gotten into this thing where you have secular sciences and religious knowledge. This you have to get this out of your head with the medievals, for sure. The medievals, if you talk to them in terms of secular religious, they would look at you like you're insane. It just wouldn't make any sense to them. That is, knowledge is knowledge. Religious knowledge means, for somebody like the Rambam, for a rationalist, means acquiring knowledge. That is, the enterprise of knowing the truth is itself a religious enterprise, because knowing the truth will eventually get you to know the ultimate truth in the world, which is God. So the whole pursuit of knowledge, that is, studying physics, and I don't think Einstein would disagree with him here, studying physics is, in fact, a halachic duty. It's a religious enterprise. There's no bifurcation here. I've heard to no end this garbage that you know, people, you know, he wrote the Mor Nevuchim, which is the usual thing, is, you know, for those he thought needed it, but he didn't really believe in it, whatever. It was kind of apologetics. You hear this, again, this argument goes on and on always. Nowadays it goes on about Rav Soloveitchik. So, you know, it astounds me that you can have a book that's called the Soul of the Rav, the Essence of the Rav, and completely downplay the philosophical part of Soloveitchik. People, you know, basically saying that he wrote things like The Lonely Man of Faith or those for people who don't know anything and for people who have problems, and he just, you know, anybody who's read that stuff knows that, you know, it's not just for some people. You have to be very, very qualified in a large body of knowledge to even read, to know every sentence and all the technical terms they use. But anyways, this kind of debate never ends. He here thinks that Pardes is part of Gemara, is part of the subject that you eventually get to and exclusively devote yourself to. That's the only way I could read this. Right.
Could just be a practical thing. Get all this grounding material, because you can do that within a certain period of time. But this other stuff's going to take you forever.
I mean, look, he wrote, you can see, possibly this is his life itself, his kind of historical life, charts the course of what he just laid out here. That is, the Rambam wrote, for instance, just to give you kind of a telescopic view in terms of his writings. He did write Treatise of Law on Logic, which now a guy named, it's a wonderful book, a great scholar, Herbert Davidson, who wrote Maimonides, a Biography, which was put out by, I think it's Oxford or Cambridge, a year or two ago. And he is a very kind of encyclopedic book, but he's also it's kind of Scrooge-like. That is, he virtually destroys everything you thought you knew about the Rambam, he knocks down. So virtually a lot of the things we took for granted were the Rambam's, like, for instance, the Treatise on Logic, that he says, no, this is impossible that it was written by the Rambam. And he tries to show that this was probably written by a Muslim philosopher. And he does this with a lot of things. Be that as it may, certainly these other works he wouldn't quibble with. That is, the Pirush Mishnayot, his commentary on the Mishnah, came first, in terms of the three great works, came first. The Mishnah Torah came next, finished around 1178, not to mean that he didn't go back and tinker with it every once in a while. We know that he did, and we know that he changed his mind sometimes. And then ended his life, towards the end of his life, maybe in the 1190s, right? Remember, he died in 1205, the Mor Nevuchim. So if what he says here, and I have no reason not to take him at his word here, that is, he followed his own advice. That is, the program he followed was precisely the program that he laid out here, right? Mikra, Mishnah, Halakha, Yavin Davar, Mitoch Davar, all that, right? His life charts that. And he ends off, I would say, not with something that's apologetics, not with something that's a concession, but he ends off with probably the things, not that he just thought about after he finished the Mishnah Torah, things that he had been thinking about and things that had been germinating. It can't be that he had written the first four chapters where he talks about these two sciences without a solid grounding in all those things, even though here it's very digested. That is, he gives a...
And this esoteric sort of split you off to see what Kabru, who is this, like, you know, super legalist.
Right.
And you have this Masorah, but the Maggid coming
out, right,
on
right,
Friday nights.
Right. So he was split in a different way. He was, his personality was split in a very different way. That is mysticism,
right.
And he was there in Sfat, you know, that whole business. So Rav Yosef Karo is not a follower of Maimonides in that sense.
Right.
He's a follower halachically, right? I mean, the Shulchan Aruch, of course, is, you know, bears a very strong relationship to his predecessor. He considers him his Rebbe, but he went off on his own in terms of mysticism. So again, you raise a good thing. I mean, nobody's mono, you know, the great people in our religion are always complex.
Right.
If you can peg a guy down, right, and pigeonhole him, then he's probably not a guttle. Okay? They're very complex, very complex. So as I said, his life charts virtually the projection, the intellectual progression that he has here in his Mishnah Torah. So now, if you go to Back to the first page of the first handout that I gave you.
In the first handout I gave you.
Okay. And you look at there with the mitzvah, the first mitzvah that we talked about, right, which is to know God. And then he goes on about God's not being corporeal as opposed to the way patently he's presented in the Bible, right? Virtually anthropomorphic throughout. God sees, God hears, God has a hand, God gets angry. All these things are offensive to the Rambam. And then he has four chapters devoted to what he calls the Pardes, which is basically a description of the physical world as he knew it, according to the sciences that he was familiar with. You cannot possibly accomplish that first mitzvah, the first mitzvah of to know God, the first few mitzvot of to know God, to unify God, right? To know that there are no other gods without this knowledge. It's not possible. It's not possible. That's why these are Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. These are the halachot that frame these mitzvot. That's right. That's right. So if you go to the second page, for instance, okay, if you didn't think that the mitzvah to know God included all these things, to know God and to know his unity, this is also, people kind of skip this. The second page, after those sources that I gave you about the Pardes and the Ritva, here you have Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, chapter 2, where he talks about the next couple of mitzvot, which is to fear and to love. Everybody, I think, would say, again, that these are the basic fundamental mitzvot that undergird the entire halachic framework, or the entire 613 mitzvot. Without these, everything else collapses, right? Without one incorporeal, know that he exists, to love him and to fear him, everything else collapses. What's the point of davening if you don't love him and fear him? Or don't know him, or don't know that he exists, right? What's the point of putting on tefillin? There is no point to any of these things. They're all rooted in these, and that's why they're Yisodei HaTorah. But look away, he defines it. So what is loving God? What is fearing God? Loving God means, I love you, God, give him a kiss, right? They're technical mitzvot. So if they're mitzvot, if they're halachot, they need to be clearly defined. And so the Rambam does. That is, you know, Ava isn't just some kind of, New Age romanticism, flirting with Kabbalah or whatever and just like saying, we all love you, God, right? Walk around dancing and singing all day. And fearing is not saying, I'm so afraid of God that he's going to strike me down. This is not, decidedly, the Rambam's definition. Now, look how the Rambam's definition of these two mitzvot clearly root themselves in everything I was talking about. Heichi aderech la'ahavato v'yirato. How? What is the way? How do you accomplish these two mitzvot? B'sha'ash yitbonen ha'adam b'ma'asav u'bru'a. Once man starts to understand God's creations and God's actions, hanifla'im hagdolim, v'yira mehen chachmato, and derive from them his wisdom, she'ein la erech v'lo ketz, right? That is infinite, right? We know that. I mean, science is infinite. The amount of knowledge that we derive from the world never ends, right? Miyad, as a result of this clearly intellectual process that covers everything that I just said, without a knowledge of the world, he says, Miyad hu ohev, immediately he loves, umishabeach, umfa'er, umitaveh ta'ava gdola, leida Hashem hagadol. That itself, right, instigates the desire to love God. So what is essential to the love of God is studying what God gave you, which is his creation. The only way I can ever come to know God is to extrapolate from what he has given me and what he has presented to me, which is empiricism in a way, that is an empirical grounding in the world. and all anything that tells me about the nature of something in the world brings me closer to a knowledge of God. And then from the same impulse, by the way, Yira is not something different. It's just the flip side of this same impulse. That is, when I k'mechashev the dvarim elu, when I think about these things, miyad, again miyad, who near tala chorav, he retreats back, right? V'yifached, and what is the fear? What is the tremble? Yadashehu biryak tanash feila afeila omedet bedat kalam uta lifnei tamim deyot. That is, they both emerge out of the same learning, right? But what I immediately know is I immediately have this great desire to know God. That's the love of God. But I also know that I cannot know. And this is very important. So anybody, so this is fine the way it is. Humility, right? One could say this is simply an ethical trait, humility, and it is that somewhat. And humility, of course, we know, if you look at Hilchot Deot, is one of those things that he goes against the rule of the golden mean. Those of you familiar with the Hilchot Deot, he says, basically, you guide your life, your ethical life is guided by the Aristotelian golden mean, which is balance, right? Nothing too extreme. Yet, famous contradiction in the Rambam, but we'll leave that for another time. For humility, you go to the other extreme, right? You absolute self-negation to the extreme. But the only way you could do that is by amassing tremendous amounts of knowledge. Because it's only then that you realize how much you don't know. So that one could say that life is about, and this is maybe why I think, one of the reasons why I think the Rambam really never caught on, and he wasn't really all that successful. Maybe this goes back to your question. That is, it does end up to be something that requires a lot of work, to say the least. Right? And at the end of the day, even after all that work, what I'm left with is really nothing. So what I mean by that is that one of the most famous kind of pillars of the Maimonidean thought is when he talks about the knowledge of God, we call what you can know about God, or the way the Rambam formulated what you can know about God, as a negative theology. And this is very much related, I think, to the way he formulates Ava and Yira. That is, negative theology means all I can know about God is what God is not. What God is not. I can never know what God is, because God is not anything. That is, the minute I say about God he is something, I'm already violating basically his existence and his unity. So we'll leave that aside for the moment. However, what he says is that the more I can rule out things about God, the closer I get to the knowledge of God. Now, the only way I could do that, and again, one could say, well, God is not this table, right? God is not me or you. God is not the world. And we could say that. But again, remember in previous class, I said for the Rambam, knowledge is not saying something. And knowledge is not receiving something as a tradition. And knowledge is not simply accepting something on authority. But knowledge is demonstrating something. So you don't have knowledge unless you've demonstrated. So virtually what he means is that I have to know in what sense God is other than the world. I have to know what the world is, meaning I have to know everything I can know about the world. And only once I know everything I know about what this table consists of, the construction of the table, the matter of the table, it's what we call the form, what lies behind the table, the physics of how it stands up. And know a little bit about what God is, then I could rule this out. The more I know that God cannot have any characteristics, that is, and this is something that got him a little bit into hot water as well, that is, we can't describe God and think that this is true the way the Bible describes God. That is, we can't describe him as being mighty, as being kind, as being compassionate. We can't. Actually, if you really think that God, for the Rambam, is kind and compassionate, for the Rambam, you quite literally are guilty of avodah zarah, of idolatry. If you think when you daven, and you say all those things we say in Shmoneh Esrei, Akeil HaGadol HaGibor VaNara, he talks about this, and you think those things are actually describing God, you're actually davening to what he would consider an idol, or a non-existent being, to be more charitable.
He must have known that's what the average person thinks.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And again, that's why I'm saying his program didn't catch on because of this. That is, and I think it goes beyond that. I think even if, let's say it is accessible, people don't like to work at things. For instance, I would say that the mystical model, and you see it, you see the mystical model is very attractive, and it's very attractive to people who really don't know anything, right? And I ask myself, why is it attractive? And why is it a better model than this? Or better? I mean, why is it a more popular model? And I would say partly, not exclusively, but partly because of this. That is, what is mysticism about? Mysticism, after all, demands that you accept certain things, right, about the upper world, like the sfirot, and this left side, and the right side, and the female side, and this, and right, and that when man does something, they somehow affect God himself. God himself is in need of repair. God himself is disunified. God himself is fragmented. Man brings them together, right? Man himself, right? There's one Mekubal that actually says when using probably in some way subverting the Rambam, as when the Rambam uses the rallying call of why I wrote the guide, for instance, Eit Lasot LaHashem, he says, Heferet Toratecha, this is a time, just like Rabbi Yehuda Anasi needed to write down the Mishnah when it's not, you couldn't write it down, you're not allowed to. I'm writing down knowledge about Masa Merkava and Masa Bereshit, which you're not allowed to, because of Eit Lasot LaHashem. In mysticism, it's Eit Lasot Et Hashem. It's a time to where man himself creates God. Man himself makes God. So two reasons this. One would, two reasons why I think the mystical model is more attractive. That is, one, it empowers man. It gives you a lot. Wow, I can redeem the world. I can not only redeem the world, I can fix God. I can repair God. So it's very empowering, and I believe this is much of the attraction in the popular world, especially in Hollywood. Who all think of themselves as immortal. This, especially when you get a little older, you know, some people's careers start to wane, and then you lose you're losing your immortality, and you gain it this way. I'm sure he feeds them this. It's empowering, but also, you can check your brains at the door because you don't need it. That's exactly it. It is mysterious, right? Mysticism is mysterious. That's its attraction. I simply don't have to know. This is what happens when I do this, how it happens, why it happens, why God, who says God is composed of these sefirot? I don't know. You know, like there's some tradition, fine. Who says God works this way? Who says that there is, you know, this fragmentation and then when man does a mitzvah? So, from both those points of view, that I think, or that model, even if subconsciously caught on, this requires a lot of effort. Let me.
Can you describe God in terms of Kedusha, though? Like there's no limit. There's nothing.
Well, see what you mean by. See, let's put Kedusha aside. No, he is Kadosh. He says, we just read it. V'yitim Kedushim ki Kadosh ani, right? And the Rambam talks.
But there are lots of things it says in the Torah that he obviously rejects.
Right. So the Rambam actually talks about the meaning of the word Kedusha in the third part of the guide. But I don't want to But God can be kadosh. But it, again, all these things, whatever God can be in the Maimonidean system, is never virtually what you assume it means. Kind of in our popular way of approaching religion.
He defines
kadosh. Yeah.
Also, just in terms of the negative attributes that you refer to, you know, God, but what he isn't. But even that doesn't work because, as you say, you cannot know definitively that this table is not God. Parse it down, and then you realize there's nothing really there.
Right.
There's just quanta or this, that, and the other, whatever.
Right.
What those are.
Even
have the negative.
I think the Rambam thought that you could get to God. Now that's problematic, right? It is problematic. You know, what do you get to in the end? If there is nothing I can get to, even by negative theology, what can I get to? And he uses an analogy about a ship, that something exists. And the more you play what's that game? Charade or whatever it is, right? Where you say it's not this, it's not that, it's not that. And then you finally get to that. Even that analogy is not, I think this is somewhat like your problem. We know there is a ship that exists, or there is this thing that exists, a house or a ship. It does exist, and it has all these qualities that we know of. So that's why we can get to it when we say, you know, it doesn't go on land, it's not built this way, it's not built. And we finally get to that. But with God, you don't have that, right? So that's problematic. But let's leave that aside, because I'm not trying to get to basically what the Maimonidean framework is. So he does by the way, give us a functioning model that brings all these things, to fruition in the very founding of Judaism. So the very founder of, and again here, when I say Judaism, take it with a grain of salt. In the very first chapter, and this is your second handout, where I went through the first two sources in Hilchot Talmud Torah. In the very first chapter of Hilchot Avodat Kochavim, he gives a historical account of the evolution of idolatry. Okay, so I skipped the first part, which is basically many people would say, how do you view history or historical progression? Again, it depends on in what terms you're talking about history. But if I would say technological view of history, you would say there's a straight line going up, I suppose. If you talked about a moral view of history, I think you'd probably have to temper that somewhat. I'm not sure that's the case. The Rambam's view of history is like this, peaks and valleys. So you actually start off with a perfect period at the beginning of time. That is, there is a knowledge of the existence of God and the unity of God. There is this knowledge of a one God, a pure monotheism. However, he says, that knowledge begins to deteriorate. So I skip that part because I want to get to the Abrahamic model. But basically what he says is that at the time of Enosh, people started to make mistakes, make errors. They weren't bad people, but they started to make errors. And what happened is they looked at the stars and they looked at the what are called spheres, and they saw that these things govern the world. So, you know, the sun comes up, the moon comes down, all these things govern nature somewhat. And they made the mistake. They didn't make the mistake that these are gods. They made the mistake that God wanted us to honor these things. Okay? From then on, knowledge deteriorates. So what happens is it starts off with a mistake. There are these intermediaries that are important, and God wants you, because they're so important, and they virtually govern, and the sun and the moon, right, governs your life. He wants you to pay homage to them. But eventually what happens is, telescope this, it deteriorates to the point where then people start to think that these things themselves are independent forces in the world. Then it deteriorates further to the point where images start to be made that represent these things, still not that these images are these things, then it deteriorates further to the point where the images themselves, right? So it deteriorates from perfect monotheism, a little problem, little dilution of monotheism. Monotheism gets diluted and diluted until you get to the point where he says, by the way, in the middle of all this is religion gets hijacked. This sounds very familiar. By people who use religion, right, for their own purposes. That is, they say, I'm the high priest, this star talked to me. Of course it didn't, because it's impossible for Maimonides that a star talked to the guy. And they gain power. So political power becomes associated, if you read the Rambam, with religion. That is, those who have the a hold, an exclusive hold, because the priests, and this is important to remember, and why I think this whole model for the Rambam is important. That is, knowledge is accessible to everyone. These priests, these idolatrous priests, are claiming that there's an exclusive religious knowledge that only I have, right? Therefore, it gets wrapped up with corruption and corrupt political power. That is, if I'm the only guy with this knowledge, you have to come to me. You have to give me gifts. You have to give me food, right? You only have access to the truth, if you want to call it that, through me, right? So now we get, so it's just kind of telescoped it. Now we get to what I have here. Alderach, look halacha beit, alderach zeh hayaholam holechu mitgalgel. In this way, it deteriorated, I would say. Okay? It evolved, but it didn't really evolve, because evolve has this notion of progression. It deteriorated. Achenolad, and notice the word that he uses, amudo shel olam. I think maybe he uses it because of the beginning of Hilchot Yisod HaTorah, Yisod HaYisodot v'amud HaChochmot. Here you have the personification, the human embodiment of the amud HaChochmot, the pillar of wisdom, because that's what Abraham becomes. And that's Avraham. What's his model of Avraham? His model of Avraham is the human embodiment of everything we spoke about. So, Kevan Shidigmal Eitan Zeh, and here his description of Avraham, and I put in bold the things that I thought are important, because if you read the bold and you kind of hear this, you'll know what he's doing, what he's formulating here. That is, Hitchil Shotet Bedato, again, difficult word, but let's say to roam around, right, in his mind, Hu Katan, he was young, Hitchil Lachsho Biyom Velayla. Look at the next. He started to look at the stars, basically develop an Aristotelian proof for the existence of God. That is, I don't want to get into Aristotelian science here, but they saw things moving around in circular motion without stop. Therefore, something that was infinite itself had to keep this thing in motion, or had to give it its first spin. And he came to the notion that there was this existence beyond everything else. Look at what I have in bold. V'lo haya lo melameid v'lo modia. He didn't have any teacher or anybody who would convey these things to him. Now that's important because, again, going back to what I said, it's important because for Maimonides, real knowledge is not knowledge you get simply because of authority, simply because Einstein told me it must be true, right? Probably that is true, but I don't know it if Einstein just told me it, right? I know, I can tell you the theory of relativity, the formula, but, you know, and I guess it's true, but I have no idea what it means, so I don't have that knowledge. So he is completely sui generis. That is, he was raised by parents who were taught him the Mesorah was Avodah Zarah. He went to the Beit Avodah Zarah for school, right? Netivot Avodah Zarah, right? That's where he went to. And this is, but yet he overcame everything.
I have to interject.
Yeah.
I got the Wadiya, and my son has an article in there, and I looked it all over, and apparently there's a problem in yeshivot, and the Bet Yaakov schools are accepting people. They don't accept others. I had this happen to my niece in England, that she wasn't accepted. Her husband davens in the wrong shul. So So one person says Abraham Avinu would have problems
right.
getting his kid
right.
into
for
the
sure.
yeshiva.
For sure. That's right. Because of his yichus. Because of his yichus. Exactly. Exactly. 100%. There's no way he could get an Eitz Chaim today. Right? There's no way he can get an Eitz Chaim today. No way. That's right, his yichus. But Avram had no yichus. That's exactly, but that for the Rambam is a beneficial quality. For the Rambam, Avram is the only real model. In fact, I guess the Rambam would say that we all have an obstacle because we have to overcome in a way to get back to the Abrahamic model. I assume he's giving you this model because this is a model that has to be imitated. We almost have to overcome our education, what we've been told by our parents, in order to actually know something. Go on to the next bold. V'libo mishotet u'mevin, his mind roamed around until he understood. Ad shehisig derech ha'emet ve'evin kav ha'tzedek. Until he understood the truth from his own correct demonstration. Ve'yada. And he knew. She'yesham elokai echad. Okay, one man, right? So, what's that? It's also a difficult expression. The correct line to get to this ultimate truth, right?
It's very much a Kabbalistic term.
Yeah, but this is not because of. I'm going to try and drain it all of its Kabbalistic stuff. This is not. It's exactly a model. In fact, he may have in mind already mystical notions. The mystical notions of how you get to God are not the way. This is the way, right? L'shotet bedato, melamed v'lo modia, mevin ad shehisig derech emet. These are all. These are all terms of knowledge, right? V'yada she'esham, he knows. What's the next stage? Okay, if you go to the bold, he knows that all these things, that what he grew up with is wrong. V'yada, and I'll just read the bold print. Hitchil hashiv tshuvot al b'nei ur kastim. Look what he does. He engages in debate, right? He answers. He doesn't resort to violence, right? He doesn't go on a jihad, right, and get on his horse with his sword and spread monotheism throughout the world. Look at what he does. There is a little bit of violence. We'll get to that in a second, because you always have to have a little bit of violence. But it's a tame violence. To debate with them, right? And then here's the violence. And he picks up, of course, all these things pick up on Midrash, but he gives it a very different spin. V'shiber hatzlamim. So there is a bit of violence. He does destroy, right? Physically destroy their temples, right? You need to do that. You need to resort to a little bit of violence. And then go on to the next bold. Kevan shigavar aleim brayatav bikesh hamelech lokor. Now look what happens to him. Once he starts to overcome with his barayotav, with his demonstrations, then what happens, going back to your thing, that it gets him into, because of the nature of idolatry, and because it gets so wrapped up with politics, that is, you have the guys who have hijacked religion, and it becomes political, and the reins of power, right, become identical with with religion, right? Of course, he gets into trouble, political trouble, right? And again, this picks up on Midrashim, but a very different twist to the Midrashim, right? Bikesh HaMelech Lehorgo. The king wanted to kill him. Now, here I'm not quite sure what to do with this. A little bit of a crimp and a v'naseh lo nes, a miracle happened to him, and he's picking up on, you know, that thing where, you know, he got thrown into the fire. Okay. Nes, and what he means by nes and mofet is another discussion. And needs to be looked at the way he uses it throughout the guide. However, what does he do? Go with the next bold. He leaves. He's expelled. He leaves because of political repression. V'haya mahalech v'korei u'mekabei tza'am me'ir le'ir u'mamalcha l'mamalcha. He starts to gather disciples. We don't have Judaism, right? We have a man who is dedicated to the ultimate truth in the world, which is a universal truth. There's nothing here about Jews or Judaism. Of course there isn't, right? We don't have Sinai yet, right? There's no, in fact, halakha. And, notice, what does he leave? What do you think he leaves out of in this discussion so far? That we do have with Avraham in the Bible, and we do have with Avraham in many of the Midrashim, that he leaves out. Well, worship, I mean, he knows God. He knows God. God never actually talks to him, right? God doesn't tell him to do anything, right? This is a man who has achieved a certain amount of intellectual perfection, demonstrated to himself against all odds and against everything he ever was brought up with, that there is this God, so he truly knows, and he's truly accomplished the first few mitzvot that we have, and that's why he starts off, I think, Hilchot Avodah Kachavim, because to know that there are no other gods is to follow the Abrahamic model. Okay? And he gathers around him disciples. Now, by the way, this very much sounds like, any of you who kind of have taken any philosophy courses, Socrates. I mean, this is kind of Socrates. Like, Socrates is the one who goes around, causes political trouble because he knows the truth, engages people in debate, right? Starts to knock down prevailing truths, okay? And gathers disciples and eventually gets into deep, deep trouble with the authorities. This is a very, very kind of Socratic model. Of course, Abraham preceding Socrates. Okay, Abraham is the real model. Socrates maybe got it from Abraham. But look what happens. When he's gaining disciples, in the bold print, Haya Modia, again, look at this. Modia, Leda, Lahasik, Tfunat, right? This is all, if you read this and read the bold loudly, you will get the point, right? Haya Modia, Lekol Achad, Bechad, Kefi Dato, Achi Achzirero, Lederach HaEmet, and Derach HaEmet, again, is another technical term. Sometimes he uses dat ha-emet. Sometimes he uses Judaism. And instead of saying Judaism, he says dat ha-emet, which doesn't mean the halachic framework of Judaism. Dat ha-emet means the true religion, which is a universal, a religion that stands for universal principles that are true for all men. Then what does he do? He realizes his mortality. V'chiber bo sfarim. Okay, so he's not gonna be able to do this forever. He's gonna die. He has to leave a teaching, and he writes svarim. Vodi al Yitzchak beno. He leaves a legacy, and then go on to the next. And then there are leaders that are appointed from his family. V'nasi sit ba'olam uma shehi yodat et Hashem. Not a religion. An uma. Uma is the same, by the way. There are many Arabic, what we call calques, that is when you translate something he has in mind as from Arabic into, it could be that Ummah is the nation, the Islamic nation, that he very much is building up here something that parallels that. That is, these guys think they have something, they may have something because he considered Islam monotheistic, but Abraham built up a universal, right, body of truth to which all men could join, right? To which all men could listen to if they listen, to which all men could be convinced of by the truth, not by the sword. Okay? And then look what happens. Atcha archu yomim, then again, catastrophe strikes. So because history works this way, and this is important, they eventually, this body, or this ummah, that its unifying factor, its socially cohesive framework is a knowledge of the truth. Here's a body of people who ultimately are defined not by race, right? Not by religion, so to speak, but they all subscribe to a truth. That's what binds this group together. And Mila, by the way, you may ask, because there is a mitzvah of Mila. maybe next week I'll talk about it, but Mila, the way he describes it, is exactly that. Mila is a sign of those who want to belong to a body of people, a social unit, that believe in this principle. So that the ultimate sacrifice you want to do, that's pretty bad, right? It's painful. It's something that you carry around all your life. Men. This is problematic. What do women do? I mean, that's another. There's a guy who had actually, Shia Cohen from Harvard. I don't know if you saw it. You should have him in, by the way, for a term motion. But he wrote a whole book of do Jewish women, I forget the title, something like, do Jewish women need to be circumcised? He has an entire book tracing if Mila is the bris. Is the Brit. And Mila, circumcision, is how you gain entry into the covenant with God. Where do women stand? How do women become part of that Brit? It's problematic. And he goes through a whole history, fascinating book. He goes through a whole history of different views of how women become part of the Brit. But leave that as it is. Mila is simply for him a physical sign of a belief. There's nothing magic to it. It's an initiation, right, into a fraternity. That's right, because, you know, initiation is the fraternity. You give them some hard test to pass. This is, then you know the guy really, really subscribes to this belief. But look at what happens. What happens is, if you go to the next page, they're this long stay in Mitzrayim when this belief again begins to deteriorate, almost becomes totally neglected and almost becomes forgotten. This idea that Abraham introduced into the world, that was there already before, now is almost... And here he picks up on Midrashim again. Nothing here, by the way. Everything you'll find some source in, but with a little twist. That is, we know there's lots of Midrashim that the Jews in Egypt became so assimilated. We have a Midrash that, for instance, I'll just give you one of the most extreme Midrashim that the Rambam does pick up on. That is, why do you take the Seh, the Passover sacrifice? Why do you take this particular one, right? So there is a Midrash, and Maimonides picks up on this in the guide, that says, take the God that you've become accustomed to, because they worship this thing, right, and slaughter it, right? It's a sign for Maimonides. It picks up on this Midrash, right? But a Midrash that shows it became so assimilated that they adopted idolatry, almost became complete idolaters. And what happens? A new kind of figure needs to arise. In the evolution of religious history, no longer the Abrahamic model failed. It failed. It didn't last. So Moshe Rabbeinu, who is a different figure, Rabban shel kol hanaviim, v'shalcho, Kaven Shinitna Bay Moshe Rabbeinu. Now we need revelation, right? We need a truth that is conveyed by revelation. Ubachar Hashem Yisrael Nachala Hichtiran b'mitzvot. Now you have law, right? He crowned them with mitzvot. An interesting word, and maybe we'll talk about it next week. V'hodiam derech avodato. He let them know the way of worship, which is the halachic framework, the 613 mitzvot. Umayyeh, and now we need a little bit of a stick too. It's not enough. The Abrahamic model failed. So it's not enough. We need something else besides simply convincing people of the truth. I can hit people over the head with these arguments. It lasts a little bit. There needs to be something else, and there's a political need for this yishuv dat, that he provides them with the mitzvot, and mayyeh mishpat avodat kochavim v'kol ha-toim achareah. What will be the punishments? I got punishments now. There's a stick. If you go, right? Not everybody's going to be able to get to this truth without some incentive, some negative incentive. Moshe is a very, very different figure than Avraham. But this coincides and consistent with the previous sources that I gave you. That is, what Moshe brought into the world is exactly those things that you need. The things, the Havayot Debaya, that lead eventually to Havayot Debaya Varava. The things that lead eventually to Pardes. Abraham was solely involved in Pardes. That is, he eventually got to the truth because of those sciences that we call Pardes. He had no Havayot Debaya Varava. He had no Halacha, right? He had no Nivuah, so to speak, in the strict sense of the word, and maybe we'll touch on what Nuva is in the last class. But it failed. the Rambam understands that there is a political, socio-political need for the halachic framework in order to retrieve the Abrahamic Ummah.
So,
which is parde-centered.
And parde is esoteric.
It's esoteric knowledge, but it's not esoteric in the sense of the mystical esoteric knowledge. That is, it's esoteric knowledge to which people have access, providing they have the qualities. Okay, and this is a problem, because it is a bit elitist. You have to be, you know, you have to have the brains for it. But it's not esoteric knowledge in the sense that it's not accessible, right? Or it's a realm of knowledge that it beyond the human mind. So this is very important. If I have a moment, does everybody have a moment just to give you one very interesting? I end off with this Hasagat HaRavid. You know, so everybody knows the Ravid, Rabbi Abraham ben David of Pasquiers, who lived around the same time and took on the Rambam. Ravid was also mystically bent. In fact, he gave rise. His son, Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Nohar, Isaac the Blind, was a very, very famous mystic. In fact, one of the prominent leaders of the circle in Girona from which Nachmanides stemmed. The Ravid took, we saw the Ravid in the introduction where he immediately chops down the Rambam, where the Rambam says, all you need is this book and nothing else, remember? So the Ravid comes in here with a gloss. And it's important to understand, this is not just a trivial thing. It may sound trivial at first. He says, the Ravid says, what do you mean? The Rambam says that when he's 40 years old, Abraham got to this knowledge. He says, what do you mean? Yesh Agadah ben Shalosh Shanim. There's a famous Agadah that he was 3 years old when he came to God. Now, this is an interesting gloss. And why the Ravid decided to do this, right? Because this is kind of trivial. What's the difference whether he's 40 or 3? It really is trivial. And there are, by the way, midrashim that the Ravid knew very well of that don't have metri. Midrashim, not all midrashim, right? There are having that 40, girsaot that have 48. So there are others. So there is a good reason why the Ravid did this. He wants to destroy this whole model. That little gloss undermines the entire model. Because if Avraham knew all this when he was 3, he couldn't have come to it by a natural progression. A 3-year-old doesn't come to it by natural progression. A 3-year-old comes to this knowledge by a ness or by God talking to him. This is extremely important. It's not a trivial point, right? He undermined the entire model of Avram, where it's Leida, Laharachdin, Leida, Lashotet Bedato, Hasig Bitfunato Nechona. Kesef Mishnah, by the way, who always comes to the Rambam's defense, if you look at that, says, you know, he defends the Rambam very often. He says, you know what, I have a way of, yes, you know, Ravid, you're right, 3 years old. There are other ones that say 40, 48. What did he do? Shalosh shanim haya kishehitchil lachshov v'lashotet v'machshavto. He was 3 when he began the process. Aval kishaya ben arba'im hishlim lachiro. When he was 40, it is quite brilliant. Brilliant. The Kesef Mishnah kind of says, of course he started when he's 3, and you know, 3 is not so. Beethoven, when he was 3, was already composing music, apparently. Not so far off. But this was a long process, 37 years, and when he was 40, a brilliant, actually, I think, solution. But this is a very, very, not a trivial thing. This is for the heart of this model, the Ravid has destroyed with this little gloss. He's destroyed the Abrahamic model. He doesn't want this to be the model. So next week we'll finish with, I think I want to show actually some of actual halachot that demonstrate this kind of model throughout the Mishneh Torah.
Why does he want this to be the model?
Because he doesn't want the purely intellectual progression towards God to be the be-all and end-all of Jewish religion, which is what the Rambam is saying. That is, Abraham never was, he never, God never spoke to him. He didn't get this. He didn't get this knowledge from on high.
That's correct.
This is a
program of natural ethics. Everybody's.